Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, Georgi Dinkov, also known as Hadut. Georgi Dinkov is very active in the bioenergetic community, and he's a common guest with Ray Pete on the Generative Energy Podcast with Danny Roddy. And he's just a very knowledgeable and very smart guy. Really an honor to talk to Georgi and pick his brain for everything he knows. So stay tuned. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayton Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Tyler Woodward.
How are we doing today, Jayton?
I'm doing well. And we also have a very special guest on today, Mr. Georgi Dinkov.
Hi, everybody.
So I'm sure if you're aware, if you're in the bioenergetics community, you obviously have heard of Georgi and his company, Ideal Labs. But Georgi, you want to just give a quick background?
I've been basically participating in the bioenergetic community probably around since circa 2011. But I've been dabbling in biochemistry and bioinformatics since 2002. In fact, that's what first got me into the whole biochemical field, is that I was working as a IT guy for basically an outfit here that was doing a lot of biochemical research. And being an IT guy, you know, I'm surrounded by 40, 50 really bright, at least so I thought at the time, very bright medical people. And if you want to participate in their community, you have to learn the language in order to be able to speak to them. So that's how I got into this. Between 2002 and 2005, I worked along those people and sort of acquired a little bit of the lingo. And after that, it's been all reading PubMed studies and experimenting with myself. I was a low carber for several years. That backfired badly for me. And then around 2011, I basically stumbled upon Dr. Pete's work, Ray Pete, by Googling, trying to find some information on aspirin and its effects on the brain. And one day I typed aspirin brain, and then one of the top results, which is no longer the case, by the way, because Google is now censoring, was Dr. Pete's article on aspirin and brain and cancer. And that's how I got into this whole bioenergetic field. And I've been working on it ever since. And now I'm even starting to do my own studies, my own experiments with animals, and hopefully human studies soon as well. And so far, everything that I've seen, even if it doesn't 100% confirm the bioenergetic idea, it most certainly invalidates almost everything that we've been told by the experts on media. In fact, there's this, I think there's this website called 180 Degree Health, which basically says if you don't want to worry and think about things too much, effectively take whatever your doctor is telling you and do the exact opposite, and you'll be right 9 days out of the time if you don't want to put any thought into it.
That's funny, crazy. I mean, not wrong in a lot of cases, at least. So we've got a couple questions prepared for you, or more than a couple questions. And the topic of this podcast predominantly is going to be on EFAs. So just as like a pre-background for our listeners, like the EFAs or essential fatty acids are the omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, which have multiple double bonds. Omega-3 stands for every three bonds, they have a double bond. Omega-6 is six double bonds. So they have between three and six double bonds total, which makes them highly unstable and much more likely to undergo lipid peroxidation, among a number of other things. So a lot of Dr. Pete's work is based on this idea that these EFAs are in somewhat not essential or unnecessary, and that when your diet is deficient in the EFAs, omega-3 and omega-6s, that you start to produce this omega-9 known as meat acid. And the meat acid can play a large role in the body and take a lot of, or be used instead of these omega-3s and omega-6s. So my question is, are the EFAs truly unnecessary? Like, do we not need them at all? Or is it just that it's pretty impossible to be deficient in them because they're in everything?
The question on their efficiency has never really, really been fully resolved, because most of the studies that work with those continuously cite each other in a sort of like they create this loop. And then the ones that are referring to the original, I call it the original evil, is the study by Burr, by basically a professional, medical professional and his wife, who I think did the only true experimental study back in the 1930s. And then they discovered that if you deprive the animals of the omega-6 fatty acids, they basically develop various dermatological symptoms, such as a scaly skin, or sometimes the skin may actually crack. They're prone to bleeding. And basically they don't grow as much, no matter how much food you give them. And this already gives you a hint of what really the effects of the polyunsaturated fats and their deficiency really is, their metabolic regulator. And then he basically concluded that even though these rats didn't die, they were actually pretty fine. Just the external appearance wasn't very, pleasing. So he decided that this is essentially a pathological state. And he termed it, you know, he termed those essential, these fat acids essential. In other words, that are essential for health. And ever since then, actually initially between the 1930s and maybe until the 1960s until the real pro-PUFA campaign began, their usage wasn't very widespread in the diet. It was actually only added in commercial foods, of which there weren't that many. Most people were cooking their food at home. They were only added in very small amounts because the boers basically stipulated how much that would be needed to prevent an essential fatty acid deficiency. And according to them, for a human, that would be between 1 and 3 grams daily. So that's really what the usage was commercially. But let me tell you that right now we're consuming the majority of the fats that we're eating from commercial food is actually polyunsaturated fats. So instead of 1 to 3 grams daily, which was to prevent the EFA deficiency, even assuming it was actually bad, we're basically now consuming, 70 to 80 grams of PUFA daily. That's really, that's not what even the birds intended. But then subsequent studies demonstrated, as a sort of like a peripheral finding, that the animals that are essential fatty acid deficient, they seem to be remarkably resilient to a host of assaults that are commonly used in the lab. Like if you inject them with a lethal dose of endotoxin, basically none of the rats or the mice or the rabbits that were made EFA deficient, none of them died. Endotoxin can be reliably lethal beyond a certain dosage, and they even have established like those ranges which are lethal, LD30, LD50, etc., for pretty much all the species that are out there, including for humans. And they discovered that, experimentally, those animals that were EFA deficient, they were very resilient to endotoxin death. They were very resilient to carcinogens. They were very resilient to ionizing radiation. So basically, they would have to irradiate them with the equivalent of 20 to 30 times the lethal dose that will kill a normal animal or a normal human, meaning non-EFA deficient. So it's almost like these rats could survive a nuclear war, if they're, sufficiently distanced from the actual blast that will kill them from the heat. But as far as exposure to radiation goes, it looked like these animals were remarkably resilient. The dermatological symptoms and some of the hematological symptoms were still there, but it was never really resolved if those were caused by the actual absence of the essential fatty acids or there was something else in play. And then subsequent studies with mostly people who have been on total parenteral nutrition, so-called, maybe they've had their gastrointestinal tract resected and taken out. People with Crohn's disease sometimes have that, their entire colon or other portions of the GI tract removed. So some of them may actually be on a intravenous / parenteral nutrition for life. And it's somewhat common in those people to develop essential fatty acid deficiency. I mean, there are multiple case studies demonstrating that in such people, most of their inflammatory symptoms completely resolve, even though the dermatological symptoms appeared again. And some of the studies focused on the neonatal state of essential fatty acid deficiency and what happens to babies when they are fatty acid deficient, when they're not. And several studies that I found demonstrated. So first of all, most of the studies that are claiming that deficiency in omega-3 or omega-6 will cause mental retardation or growth stunt and delayed development are actually based on preterm children. Now, for those, these are already established risks. This is not something that the EFA deficiency actually caused de novo by itself. Any preterm infant is a dramatically higher risk of premature death. I mean, many of them don't even survive until the age of one. And then even if they do survive, then basically they have multiple organ damage, stunted growth, and of course, cognitive issues. And then the studies that looked at the essential fatty acid deficiency in such babies, I found quite a few that basically stated that with the exception of the dermatological symptoms, almost all of the infants were doing perfectly fine. Now, what did happen is that the infants that were on a really, truly in state of EFA deficiency, they all of them, without exception, had a dramatically higher resting metabolic rate. Now, of course, now you can kind of imagine why the studies that saw, that wasn't with premature infants and that still had EFA deficiency, why they may have found growth stunt and cognitive issues later in life. Well, if these babies have a, you know, 2 times higher metabolic rate, and you still continue feeding them the calories that are being, you know, designated for regular babies with regular metabolism, well, of course, you're basically malnourishing them. They will have developmental problems and cognitive problems as well. And multiple studies found out that that was actually the only difference that they could find between the two groups, is that the EFA deficient babies had a much higher metabolic rate and wanted to consume, you know, much higher amount of calories. And many doctors were taken aback and said, "Nah, it's not good. It's going to get the baby, you know, obese even by very early age. You know, we're not supposed to be feeding a baby 2 times more calories daily than what the baby is supposed to eat." Yeah, but who's saying how much is a baby or an adult supposed to eat? All depends on your metabolic rate. Anyways, back to the symptoms of EFA deficiency. Some studies have suggested that many of those symptoms can be removed or greatly mitigated by feeding additional amounts of zinc or the B vitamins, and or could be both, into the diet, which suggests that basically the reason for the appearance of these dermatological symptoms is simply, again, because of the higher metabolic rate. Not only you're consuming, and if you continue to eat the same amount of calories as what medicine is telling you as an adult or, you know, a preterm infant should be eating, then you will be, by definition, getting into a multiple nutrient deficiency. Biotin deficiency can cause the symptoms of associated with EFA deficiency. Zinc deficiency can cause these. Selenium deficiency can cause a lot of these problems with nails and hair that are also being seen. Now, the one thing that is probably true of essential fatty acid deficiency is that it will decrease platelet aggregation. So it may make you more prone to bleeding, but it's not clear that this effect is stronger than what like a tablet of aspirin will do daily. And in fact, if anything, we're actually more prone to clotting than we are to bleeding. Very few people out there are truly prone to bleeding, and only those that are taking warfarin. And even for those people, they don't really give them anything. They just say, "Well, we need to monitor you like every, you know, couple of months just to make sure, you know, you have to go for a surgery or you hurt yourself, that you're not bleeding to death." And EFA deficient people are nowhere near that level, right? So all of this fear mongering about, you know, essential fatty acid deficiency making you prone to bleed to that has never been shown, not even one case, or at least never been published. On the other hand, all of these sort of like mostly cosmetic symptoms, such as skin problems, hair problems, etc., seem to be resolvable by simply both increasing the calories to match the increased metabolic needs, and also increasing the amount of nutrients correspondingly, so that they match the increase in calories and the increase in the, you know, in the needs of the metabolic rate. However, studies on this have not been done. We don't know if your metabolic rate doubles whether you need twice the amount of zinc or maybe even more. The requirements for the micronutrients don't always grow linearly with the increase in the metabolic rate. Sometimes they grow exponentially, sometimes logarithmically. I mean, for something like vitamin D, actually, the requirements with increased metabolic rate grow logarithmically, but for vitamin A, grow exponentially. So without actually doing these studies, and none of them have been done, we don't really know. But what we do know is that basically all of the metabolic problems or developmental problems associated with essential fatty acid deficiency are actually mostly null. They're not really problems per se, except that if you're restricting, if you're not providing enough food for the resultant increase in the metabolic rate associated with essential fatty acid deficiency. And then also, you know, conversely, the cosmetic symptoms, such as mostly related to skin and hair, are actually largely solvable by providing even one or, you know, or just a few of the nutrients that are known to increase with increased metabolic rate. And even without any studies, we already know that just giving a little extra zinc, maybe, you know, instead of 10 milligrams daily, consume 20, is enough to mitigate most of these symptoms. So I have not seen any evidence, basically, that says that provides clear evidence. I've not seen any conclusive evidence that essential fatty acid deficiency is actually pathological in the long run. Having poor skin, having scaly skin and dry hair and maybe brittle nails is not necessarily a sign of pathology. It could be a sign just of a nutrient deficiency, right? Not of necessarily of the body something developing some kind of a disease. The biggest argument that's come in favor of the essential fatty acids is usually from the studies with babies. They'll say, well, the baby seems to be accumulating a lot of omega-3 just before gestation, just before birth, and it seems to accumulate preferentially into the retina and the brain, right? And without those omega-3s, you're going to have like retarded babies and blind babies and whatnot. Well, a couple of things that could explain the preferential accumulation. The baby basically is absorbing most of these fatty acids from the blood. In other words, from whatever the mother is eating, whatever the mother is providing. And now we have studies showing that when the mother eats a combination, a mixture of different fats, the saturated fats are preferentially oxidized in the mother's organism. And then the polyunsaturated fats, both omega-3 and 6, are actually being esterified, converted to triglycerides, and sent out in the peripheral circulation for storage and consumption by other tissues, right? So it's normal if the mother is eating high fatty meal, or the mother is under stress or she's experiencing lipolysis, because the polyunsaturated fats are preferentially stored both in the mother's body and the baby. If the mother is under stress, even if she's not consuming a high fat meal, then the fats that she releases into her bloodstream, eventually going to the baby, are also mostly PUFA. So it is kind of expected that the baby will accumulate omega-3 and even omega-6. Some studies have said that, if you don't provide omega-3, the baby will accumulate omega-6. Well, of course, it will basically, these are both PUFAs, and that's what you will accumulate. However, studies have shown that basically if you provide a sufficient amount of saturated fat in the diet of the mother, this preferential accumulation of omega-3 and omega-6 into the baby does not occur. Consequently, studies with adults have demonstrated repeatedly that supplementation with omega-3 and, God forbid, omega-6 are most certainly not beneficial for neither brain development, brain function, especially not for things like Alzheimer's. In fact, and I'll send you some studies later on so you can post send to people if they want to see, two of the PUFA peroxidation byproducts, malondialdehyde is one of them, and 3-hydroxy-1-enol are actually very highly reliable biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, he has led certain medical groups to propose that Alzheimer's disease, because the same biomarkers are also associated with diabetes, he has led some medical groups to propose that Alzheimer's disease is nothing but diabetes of the brain, which is driven, just like type 2 diabetes in general, is driven by accumulation of excessive amounts of fat. And actually, it's the polyunsaturated fats, because they produce these lipid peroxidation byproducts, which are carcinogenic, mutagenic, and generally toxic for the organism. So the argument that omega-3 is good for the development of the babies, I've not seen any conclusive study with healthy infants that will demonstrate that one group is EFA deficient and the other one gets omega-3. And again, we're not talking about preterm infants, because for preterm infants, nothing can really be said conclusively because they're already in pretty poor health. But for the healthy ones, I don't know of any studies that show that if you give one group the omega-3 and you feed the other ones, let's say an omega-3 poor or omega-6 poor, in other words, PUFA poor diet, that somehow the second group will end up in a worse situation health-wise than the first one.
So what do you think about, I'm not an expert on this, but the quantum theory of DHA and that its properties, because of its unsaturation as an electron carrier, and basically that we evolved eating animal fats, which are higher in DHA and whatnot, and that is necessary for us to see the way we do in our brain to function as fast as it does. To me, that didn't really make a lot of sense, because you would think the saturated fats would be a much more efficient energy carrier, because they're, the double bonds are basically like a fence, and every time they got to be open and closed, versus the saturated fat is basically just, or a gate versus the saturated fat is just like a fence that carries electricity very rapidly through it, versus it has to go through that gate every time. So what do you think about the role of DHA in evolution?
A couple of things. All of the evolutionary biology arguments are very nice. Unfortunately, none of them can be tested in the lab. We just cannot reproduce evolution in the lab, right? If I wanted to test something like this, I'll have to have a way to reproduce evolution in a matter of, let's say, a couple of months or at most a year. Nobody's going to fund 30-year-plus studies. And even those won't be enough, because we're not going to change genetic, we're not going to cause genetic changes, even in a time span of a full human life. Those occur over tens of thousands of years. And as biology teaches us, they're random, right? So one thing I'll say is that, first of all, people who are EFA deficient, they don't go blind, okay? They don't go blind. In fact, they have increased sensitivity to light, and they're capable, and they develop a bit of a farsightedness, which, if anything, speaks to an improvement in both in either the retina's photosensitivity or the brain's ability to process the signal that's coming from the retina. Second thing, macular degeneration, which is a disease of the retina, which happens used to happen in elderly people, now is basically rapidly increasing in the middle-aged groups and even the young people as well.
And diabetics
can be reliably
as well, right?
Induced. Exactly, diabetics as well. It can actually immediately will tell you that the issue here is basically if diabetes is a disease of excessive fatty acid accumulation and mostly PUFA, then it's probably the PUFA is not going to be beneficial for this condition. But of course, this is still just a hypothesis, but there's also experimental evidence now showing that if you feed animals basically a sufficient amount of omega-3 or omega-6, or worse, both, then you're basically increasing the rates of the macular degeneration. Macular degeneration has a very close correlation with the accumulation of lipofuscin, and lipofuscin cannot form without the presence of either omega-3 or omega-6. And by the way, the omega-3 generated much more easily because they're much more easily peroxidized. So the lipofuscin is essentially a combination of one of the PUFA peroxidation byproducts and iron. So it forms this really like hard to dissolve gunk, which accumulates in many cells, but the retina and the brain are especially susceptible to it. And accumulation in the retina of lipofuscin is considered to be one of the causes, or at least very highly correlated with the development of macular degeneration. So if feeding animals omega-3 and omega-6 can actually cause retinal degeneration in young adults and elderly people, then to me, the argument, you know, that we should be feeding it to babies is without any evidence. I haven't seen any evidence that feeding it to babies is detrimental, but I certainly don't see, I have not seen so far any evidence that we have to feed it for babies because it's somehow essential for the development of their brain or vision. There is no evidence for that.
In that regard, so do you think it's most of the lipid peroxidation, which is like when the free radicals hit everything in the cell, bouncing around and cause lipid peroxidation, the base of those double bonds to break apart, which results in the formation of like malonyl aldehyde, like the base, which is like glue that just wrecks the cell. Do you think it's worse? Is that mostly from lipid peroxidation, from the iron, what's not reacting in the cell, or is it from the oxidizing of the PUFAs in the cell, or is it both?
No. The oxidation of the PUFA in the cell, basically, whether it's a PUFA or saturated fat is effectively the same. The beta oxidation is this repeated cyclical process that cuts off like two molecules every single time until the whole chain is exhausted, right? And then it gets converted into acetyl-CoA and gets fed into the Krebs cycle. So that process is fine. However, just the presence of the PUFA, because there's molecular oxygen and hydroxyl radicals floating around, they're always subject to basically portion of them reacting with that hydroxyl radical or the superoxide anion and forming a fatty acid radical, right? And those fatty acid radicals are extremely toxic. They're known to be mutagenic and carcinogenic, right? But on the other hand, the evidence for that is already conclusive. I think the NIH listed it back in 2010. It put it on its list of known human carcinogens. So they have possible, probable, and known. So malondialdehyde moved very quickly, I think, between 2001 and when it was on the list of possible ones. At this point, it's now on the list of no. Pretty much all the other aldehydes and the ones that they scare us the most, unfortunately, turns out to be the least problematic, which is acetaldehyde, which is the first step in the metabolism of alcohol. And basically they're saying, oh, alcohol, the dangers associated with it is because of acetaldehyde, just like malondialdehyde, we think it's, you know, but somehow the media attention is all on acetaldehyde and not on malondialdehyde, which we actually produce in much higher amounts on a daily basis from our food, right? Unless you're alcoholic, acetaldehyde is a lot less problematic for you than malondialdehyde is, and various other aldehydes. So basically the full number of PUFA peroxidation byproducts isn't known, but in basically they're all, without exception, toxic aldehydes or alcohols with a very unstable structure. These 3-hydroxy-1-anol, I think, is the one that was basically associated with Alzheimer's disease and diabetes. That's a type of fatty acid alcohol, but it's formed by from the peroxidation of PUFA. These things continue to react because for as long as there's more PUFA, intact PUFA left in the body, these fatty acid radicals continue reacting with the PUFA, which is inside of the cell or even floating around in the blood. And this chain reaction continues until something breaks it. And, two most well-known chain reaction breakers are vitamin C and E, right? Which immediately tells you why basically it is so important that we consume these so-called antioxidants. But it's not really, so the question is, okay, so maybe it isn't the PUFA that's the problem. Maybe it's the problem that we're generating too many reactive oxygen species, right? Okay, but even then, medicine turns out to have the whole thing backwards, right? They're saying, or on its head, they're saying, well, this is a sort of like a side effect of having very, very high metabolism because the mitochondria produce these reactive oxygen species. Turns out it's actually a side effect of having low metabolism, because in order for these reactive oxygen species to form, the reason they're forming is because the electrons are not flowing unimpededly through the electron transport chain and eventually meeting oxygen and forming water, right? They actually accumulate at one of the electron transport chain complexes, and then they start leaking outside of the inner mitochondria into the outer mitochondrial membrane and then like, into the cytosol. And that's when they start attacking, basically reacting with the PUFAs, right? But so you will not have accumulation of ROS if your metabolism was working properly and you were basically this chain of electrons from food was flowing without any hindrance, you know, from the food to the oxygen. So we're actually seeing the reason we're having PUFA peroxidation is a combination of low metabolism, or at least lower than optimal, plus the consumption of PUFA. Now, of course, if you want to improve your metabolism, by all means, I don't think it will fully eliminate the peroxidation because that peroxidation can actually form just by the sun shining on you. Because if you have like a lot of PUFA in your stores, the process of sunburning is actually just that. It's the ultraviolet light basically activating molecular oxygen in the body, and then it starts attacking the PUFA, and then that's how you get the sunburn. The sunburn is an inflammatory reaction to these toxic peroxidation byproducts that are being formed under the skin, under the influence of ultraviolet light and the molecular oxygen. So it's hard to make an argument in favor of PUFA, except, you know, if you look at some of the biggest reviews on the topic, they'll admit it. They'll say, look, if it wasn't for the essentiality of PUFA, and keep in mind, we have only one study to base this entire argument for that's been going on for almost 100 years, only one real experimental study. If it wasn't for the essentiality of PUFAs, they're saying there's very little that is actually positive in regards to omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. Every single clinical trial with them that was large enough failed. The result was either null or the opposite. So you can tell if the result was the opposite, if the clinical trial was terminated early. That usually means there have been one or more serious adverse events, SAEs, or serious adverse reaction, SARs. And that means that basically the active group that's getting the omega-3 and omega-6 supplementation is faring much more poorly than the control group or the whatever the other active groups were. So the biggest reviews on the topic concluded that had it not been for the essentiality of these fatty acids, then basically that we should not be recommending that people eat them in the amounts that we do. And even if they were essential, several large reviews said, we somehow don't know how we ended up from the original Burr recommendation of between 1 and 3 grams daily to the amount that we're eating right now. And the situation started with back in the 60s when the industry was starting to promote the PUFAs, especially as a byproduct of the agriculture industry. But they never really said you should be eating a certain amount. Somewhere around the late 80s, somehow the U.S. and in general, the Western public health agencies started recommending that basically, maybe because of the saturated fatty acid hypothesis.
That's associated with cardiovascular disease, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They were saying like, well, it's not only they're essential, so you should not only be eating between 1 and 3 grams, you should be eating a lot more so that the proportion of your unsaturated to the saturated fats is at least 3 to 1. Well, if you're consuming 100 grams of fat daily, which seems to be a fair amount, most people consume about 30 to 40 grams per meal, right? This means you're consuming, I don't know, what, 70, 80, even more grams of PUFA daily? That was not even the Burr's original recommendation. So I think we're way out there in the weeds. People are starting to recognize that fact that PUFAs are associated with disease. There are now several trials with clinical trials using drugs that actually block some of the endpoint effects of PUFA byproducts, which is the leukotrienes and the prostaglandins. There's at least one clinical trial with Alzheimer's, which basically is administering a leukotriene antagonist. I think it's called Montelukast is the drug. The drug is still there. I'm sorry, the trial is still there. It's in phase 3, which means it's past the safety stage, past the effectiveness, I guess stage 2. And now stage 3, I think, is like they're looking at a larger group before they announce. They're basically doing a multi-ethnic, geographical area studies just to confirm that the effects are statistically significant. Long story short, if the study has been going on for 5 years, considering how expensive it is, and it has not been terminated, chances are, you know, people believe that the results are promising. Again, other studies have demonstrated that if you supplement, there were older studies, that if you supplement antioxidant, especially vitamin E, you can actually largely prevent, if not the actual disease, then most of the side pathologies associated with diabetes type 2, especially kidney failure, liver disease, and some of the vascular pathologies that ultimately lead to things like a heart attack or stroke. And that's really the three things that usually do the kidney patients in are kidney failure, heart attack, or stroke. And sometimes liver failure, but more rarely. It's usually if the person also drinks and is using some kind of a hepatotoxic medication, which unfortunately many of them are because they're all statins and whatnot.
Yeah. So I just kind of want to illustrate this for the listeners and you can correct me wherever. But so if you kind of imagine like the cell, like a highway, right? And everything is, the goal is to get to your destination where the electron acts as the terminal, electron acceptor, breaks apart water and forms ATP and whatnot. Sugar is the fastest, so it's going to be the most smooth. Like, there's no traffic on the highway. Everything's going clear. All the electrons are flowing smoothly through. When you start to burn fat, it starts to slow down because beta oxidation, thank you, is slower. So it results in more reactive oxidative species. So that kind of starts to build up a traffic. And the issue isn't the oxidative stress where it's the cars are just, let's say, hitting each other. It's this traffic that builds up. And now all these electrons start hitting each other because there's just a buildup of these electrons or the cars, right? So the reductive stress, this buildup in traffic, causes the oxidative stress because these cars or these electrons are moving through the electron transport chain at a slower rate. So it's kind of like a pinball machine where all these things are bouncing around, hitting each other, which results in these lipid peroxidase and byproducts like malonaldehyde, the 3-enol, the aldehydes that you were talking about. And the issue with metabolizing, not only it's partially fat, but also the PUFAs is because they have less hydrogens, correct? Because they have less electrons?
That's what allows them to get peroxidized. A fully saturated fat does not have a place of attack for any of these reactive oxygen species. So if you're eating a fully saturated fat and you were EFA deficient, you wouldn't be hypometabolic, by the way. It's nice that these things go hand in hand. But if somehow you were administered a metabolic inhibitor to have these drugs to test in the lab and you generated a lot of reactive oxygen species, then you wouldn't be producing those highly toxic aldehydes and some of the sort of like the short chain toxic unsaturated alcohols as well, the 3-hydroxy-1-enol. To use the analogy, basically, like once you have, so you have the car speeding along the highway, right? And then there's basically, let's say, four checkpoints, right? And then basically each checkpoint can handle, you know, only so many cars at a time. But basically, if you're in optimal health, there's no inflammation, you're probably regenerating the necessary cofactors for the processing of all these cars, so to speak, which is really electrons, right? Then everything's fine. At the end is oxygen. It accepts those electrons / cars and then converts it to water. Everything's fine. However, if one or more of these checkpoints starts to get, saturated for whatever reason exactly, then what these cars happen is basically you can think of the highway as like a hose. So initially it's going to expand a little bit, right? There's going to be an accumulation of cars around the checkpoint. It's almost like exiting a toll road. But eventually the cars are going to start spilling outside of the highway. And that spillage of the cars outside of the highway, these cars are not peaceful. think of them as criminals. They will look around for vulnerable places to actually attack. And those places of attack, the easiest ones, are the polyunsaturated fats that are going to be outside of the highway. So the highway is inside the mitochondria. And basically the fats are mostly outside of the mitochondria, outside of the highway, especially around the outer layers of the cell, which they call the lipid bilayer. But that's another thing that Dr. Pete does not agree with, because there are multiple studies showing that even if you damage the cell, if you damage the lipid multilayer, then the cell does not lose its content, does not spill its waters outside, right? So if you're taking like minced meat, which is, you know, and you can actually continuously mince it into finer and finer pieces. So this process should be damaging a lot of the cells. But if you take minced meat and squeeze it, you will not be able to squeeze any water outside. So the model of the cell is a bag of water is wrong. We know that. And to me, actually, stunningly, apparently there's, I saw the study. In 2014, there was a study coming out of Harvard. There's an entire team that works there. And they've been calling for at least 20 years for medicine to change its attitude on the cell, that the cell should be treated as a sphere made of gel, of jello. Right? And they say they brought up the same analogy. They're saying, look, just because the cell endures some damage to its surface doesn't mean it, we're not seeing it basically like spill its entrails into the ceramics. We're not seeing that. There's something else that basically, as long as the cell is alive, can maintain its electronic structure with the potassium inside, binding the proteins and creating the structured water, which is what Dr. Pollack was talking about. You basically have a coherent entity, and it does not basically like, let itself disorganize. Now, if you deprive it of ATP, which is the crucial component, so sort of like the cement holding all these proteins together, the cardinal absorbent, then the cell readily actually disintegrates, right? Without you actually causing any structural damage, which shows you why energy is so important. Because if ATP is the final product of this, like the highway, and eventually when the electrons combine with oxygen, basically, and then there's like a reverse process with some of the protons coming back through the inner mitochondrial membrane and going into ATPase and basically creating ATP synthase, creating ATP. So if this process is not working, if you're not synthesizing enough ATP, which depends essentially on energy, medicine thinks ATP is the energy. No, it's actually the final byproduct of the energetic flow, but it's a very important structural like a component that keeps the structure together, but it depends on energy. So no energy, no ATP. And without sufficient ATP, the cell literally disintegrates and all hell breaks loose. And I'm sure you've seen the studies, cellular debris in the body cause all kinds of autoimmune reactions. The body treats them as like sort of foreign pathogens because it's not expecting to see portions of the mitochondria floating around. Anyways, the PUFOs can actually do that as well because they interfere. They're not only their peroxidation byproducts are not only attacking other PUFOs and creating more fatty acid radicals. The fatty acid radicals are actually capable of inhibiting multiple steps of this like sort of electron flow on the highway. It's not just four checkpoints. There's things like the total of like maybe 27. If you count glycolysis, Krebs cycle, electron transport chain, glycolysis seems to be fairly immune to any kind of interference. And conversely, any interference with glycolysis sufficiently immediately kills the cell. And there are very, 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 very few, very rare diseases where babies are born with mutations that basically have like impaired glycolysis. They usually don't survive beyond a week. But the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain, which are inside the mitochondria, they're very susceptible to, if not damage, at least interference by these reactive oxygen, both the reactive oxygen species and the lipid peroxidation byproducts, which means you're impeding the electron flow, creating even more spillage, right? So it's like a chain reaction, a self-sustaining chain reaction, which unless you break it, right, and there are multiple ways to break it, it's eventually going to wreak havoc and kill the cell. And ultimately, even if it doesn't kill the cell, then it's going to cause some sort of like a, unchecked growth. So you either the cell commits apoptosis or it breaks apart if there's no sufficient ATP, sort of like in a necrotic cell death, or becomes a cancerous cell, right? So all of these things can actually be caused even by, definitely by the PUFO peroxidation byproducts. But now we're finding out even by the actual intact PUFOs themselves, because they have this sort of like an endocrine effect, which stimulates cellular growth.
Do you know why that people tend to supplement with molecular hydrogen to neutralize the electrons? Is that something that's actually effective?
I haven't done it myself. I've seen several people ask Dr. Peak. He said it's an effective antioxidant. I'm imagining it probably neutralizes the superoxide anion, probably. It basically converts it directly into water. I mean, I doubt that it directly saturates the PUFOs. That would be incredible if that actually does that. But to my knowledge, it probably happens in the guts of some ruminant animals if you supplement them with hydrogen, because they have bacteria in their like the three portions of their GI tract. They may be able to take some of the hydrogen, extra hydrogen, and actually saturate the PUFO more easily. They do it anyways, but with extra hydrogen, it will probably be even more efficient. I think for the humans, the primary effect is basically quenching the reactive oxygen species. So if it's going to combine with hydroxyl radical, and form water, and same thing with the superoxide anion, right? And those are probably about 80% of your reactive oxygen species.
So the only downside to burning the PUFA is just you're going to get less electrons than you'd get from burning saturated fat, and then obviously less than you're going to get from glucose, which is going to result in less ATP, but it's also going to result in increase in reactive oxygen species because you're creating less energy.
not the only, that's the only downside if they're basically oxidized in the cell where they are from.
Okay.
If they have to get spilled into the bloodstream, which usually happens under the effects of adrenaline, right? Then you have it, you're talking about a whole different cascade. Okay. You're talking about the endocrine effects. You're talking about their sort of like pro-inflammatory effects, because some cells will convert the omega-6 into arachidonic acid and then to prostaglandins and leukotrienes, right? Those have universally bad effects. Nobody's denying that, not even doctors, right? Then you also have the endocrine effects, because of their double bonds, they structurally mimic the effects of estrogen, right? They're structurally similar to estrogen. So the effects are similar to estrogen. They make the cell where they accumulate more hydrophilic. So the cell becomes more permeable, more susceptible to accepting whatever's coming in from the bloodstream, and especially water. And any accumulation of water, basically, that increases the pH with the cell, in other words, makes it more alkaline, that stimulates all kinds of growth processes in the cell, and ultimately, it's cancer. So if you look at cancer cells, their extracellular environment is extremely acidic because they synthesize a lot of lactic acid, but because it's so toxic even to the cancer cells, they immediately export it out. They're lactate transporters, which are almost unlimited capacity. They immediately export it out. So the cancer cells inside, if you measure the pH, is actually almost alkaline, and it's while the extracellular space is acidic. And this whole idea of like drinking alkaline water and whatnot, it may have its uses if there is any way to actually neutralize the lactic acid extracellularly. But the real problem is that the inside of the cell is alkaline. So what we need is actually us to acidify the cell. And if you acidify the cell, that allows the excess calcium that has accumulated inside to be released. And then basically you're going to have a blood pH, which will be slightly in the alkaline region. And then the intracellular pH will actually be slightly acidic. That's really the healthy cell, because it's producing a lot of carbon dioxide, which will keep the pH a little bit lower. And then the high carbon dioxide, as it flows out of the cell, it drags calcium with it. And also the NAD to the NADH ratio, which also depends on the redox status of the cell, also determines how much calcium is released from the cell. The higher the NAD to the NADH ratio means the more oxidized state you are, the cell is, the more calcium we're going to get expelled from the cell.
And you can imagine if you're having trouble visioning like the structured water, it's like an egg yolk, right? So you crack an egg and the egg yolk stays together. It's because of all the ATP, the proteins, that negative charge that's in the cell. And so the issue, and one of the ways I like to think about it with PUFAs structurally, right, besides, let's say, not looking at the lipid peroxidation, is just that they're more watery. And so like it's more nitric oxide. And so you have this influx of water. So the cells become more like this bulk water versus this egg yolk, this structured water where everything, all the proteins are tightly packed together and the cell, all the electrons can flow efficiently, versus the more PUFA, the more estrogen you're going to have, the more probably cortisol, nitric oxide, which impede this flow of electrons because the cell gets more bulky. It's more bloated, basically.
Yes. And actually you can, there's a very famous, it's a prank. Well, it's not a prank, but it's something that bodybuilders practice. I would not recommend it, but if you want to confirm without any doubt that PUFA, what the effect of PUFA is, go to Google and type bodybuilders injecting oil in muscles. And you'll see that basically there's this trend right now for bodybuilders before going to a competition or just to impress their friends and whatnot. They're injecting peanut oil or corn oil into their muscles. And it's precisely this pro-edema effect of the PUFAs that are creating their muscles to swell to the point of looking almost grotesque. And to an outsider, it looks like this guy has massive muscles. In reality, it's mostly edema, mostly accumulation of water. There's great vascularity because the PUFA promote the inducible nitric oxide synthesis. They activate it, right? So that basically, it's all the things the bodybuilders want, but without having to inject steroids. Or they still inject steroids, but they may add a little bit of PUFA for the extra effect. This does not work if they inject coconut oil, which kind of should tell you, and since coconut oil is 98% saturated fat, it should tell you that it is an effect that is intrinsic to PUFA. Whether it's through their toxic byproducts or to the PUFAs themselves, PUFA in your body means edema. PUFA in your body means hydrophilic cells, which means absorbing water and basically cellular growth and hypertrophy.
Very interesting. Do you have anything else you want to talk about for PUFAs?
So what would be the benefit over vitamin E versus molecular hydrogen? Just kind of circling back to that idea.
Vitamin E has multiple sort of like endocrine effects. There's some older studies that show that it has a pro-androgenic effect together with vitamin A. We also know vitamin K has a similar effect. And I think some of the endocrine effects of vitamin E come from its opposition to estrogen. Two studies have shown that vitamin E, especially the alpha tocopherol molecule, but probably the other isomers as well, not the tocotrienols, but the tocopherols, are capable of binding the estrogen receptor and acting there as antagonists. There's also a study, I've so far found only one, that showed directly that vitamin, that the tocopherols, all of them, are also aromatase inhibitors. So you have like basically a, you know, 1-2 punch, which is very rare. Not many molecules are like that, which basically have a, you know, the androgen dihydrotestosterone is another similar molecule that has the same effects, blocks the estrogen receptor and also aromatase inhibitor. So vitamin E has these beneficial sort of like anti-estrogenic effects. And in women, it seems to spare the effects of progesterone. Older studies in the 40s that were done and the 50s that were done with progesterone found that you can produce the same progestation effects, in other words, to maintain pregnancy, if you mix progesterone, if you inject progesterone together with vitamin E. And they, and by the way, they progesterone, they dissolved it in benzyl alcohol. And then the tocopherol was alpha tocopherol acetate, which is really not the optimal version of vitamin you should be using. First of all, half of it is the synthetic, the L1, which we don't, it doesn't have any effects. Second, it's also an ester, right? So you're basically getting like, if you're injecting one, I don't know, 1 gram, you're getting only one quarter of that roughly is really having the tocopherol effect. Even that highly inefficient and potentially toxic synthetic form of vitamin E allowed basically to use progesterone dosage that was only 1/4 of what was needed to maintain pregnancy without the injection together with the tocopherol. So it has a progesterone sparing effect and likely has some pro-progesterone effects directly at the receptor level. It's also a COX inhibitor. Basically, it inhibits both cyclooxygenase 1 and 2 and some of the metabolites of gamma and delta tocopherols, which are two of the isomers, are now known to be lipoxygenase inhibitors as well. So you have this like sort of like fairly broad anti-inflammatory effect of vitamin E, plus its endocrine effect of basically opposing estrogen, which PUFA promotes. And finally, of course, you know, the chain breaking effect against PUFA, beta peroxidation.
So lipoxygenase means they're not inhibiting lipolysis, but they're, what is lipoxygenase?
You just reminded me. There's lipoxygenase, right? Which creates the leukotrienes.
Okay.
Acid, right. So arachidonic acid has two pathways, cyclooxygenase or lipoxygenase, right? Tocopherols in their native state seem to inhibit cyclooxygenase, of which there are two isoforms, 1 and 2, right? But then also some of their metabolites, at least the metabolites of gamma tocopherol and delta tocopherol, inhibit lipoxygenase, right? And then also tocopherols seem to be able to restrain excessive lipolysis very similarly to the way aspirin and niacinamide are also capable of doing. And this one effect led to some studies, older studies, I think that I read in the 70s, that proposed that vitamin E may be a viable treatment for diabetes, because even back then they knew that the diabetes condition is actually, an excess of fats in the blood. Yeah, of course, in the body, storage as well, but the problem is especially exacerbate when they eat the blood. And there's this, there were two brothers, the Shute brothers, I think they're called. I don't know if you've heard of them. Canadian doctors. They're very famous. They're if you search their names on Google, S-C-H-U-T-E, they were Canadian doctors, and they basically like spent their entire careers, I think over 40 years, treating people with very high doses of vitamin E. Their publications, which medicine continues to claim they were just case studies. Yes, they are, because they didn't have a control group. But if they publish 4,000 successful cases of cured diabetes type 2 with vitamin E, I would personally take notice. But of course, not modern medicine.
What are your thoughts on the auto-oxidation of the vitamin E when you have, I think it's mostly, it was shown in plants, but like you put enough vitamin E as alpha tocopherol, and it starts to auto-oxidize, or, you know, it starts to act as a oxidant in cell instead of acting like an antioxidant.
Well, to act as an oxidant, it first needs to get converted into something called a hydroquinone.
Okay.
So the tocopherol, if you look at the molecule, basically, some of those hydroxyl groups, one of them can become an actual carbonyl group. And that's basically when it's like a semiquinone. And a semiquinone can have pro-oxidant effects. But I don't think these effects overwhelm, or I've never seen cases where providing like a vitamin E as a supplement has ever had a pro ROS effect, right? So pro-oxidant effect is not necessarily bad, right? In fact, you want it because a hydroquinone can accept one electron, right? We already know the quinones are beneficial. They can accept, most of them can accept two electrons, right? So hydroquinone is not necessarily bad. It's maybe only in a situation where a hydroquinone is in a direct proximity of one of those fatty acid radicals. Maybe it can convert into something even more toxic, but we would have seen it by now in large experimental studies. I don't know of a large experimental study, in other words, where there was intervention with vitamin E that actually produced a pro-ROS effect and somehow worsened biomarkers such as the T-bars, right, which is measures the thiobarbituric acid reactive species, which basically is a test which measures effectively the levels of malondialdehyde in the body, because it's malondialdehyde is reacted with thiobarbituric acid, and if sufficient malondialdehyde is present, then you get this byproduct, and then can quantify it and say, hey, you have a lot of malondialdehyde in the body. All the studies that I've seen so far with tocopherol, any of the isoforms, has produced a reduction in T-bars/MDA, not an increase. So if there are pro-oxidant effects, and by pro-oxidant, I mean like somehow causing oxidative damage, I would say they're probably localized and they're only present in organisms that are saturated. That are filled up with even more highly unsaturated fats, probably the omega-3s. So I can see kind of a problem with a person who is consuming a lot of fish oil and also taking a lot of vitamin E. However, even that does not seem to be the case, because there's a used to be a very a widespread disease called yellow fat disease. To this day, it's still acknowledged as existing, but people say the medicine says it only exists in animals, especially in cats. So if you feed cats only fish food, eventually, without any supplementation, they develop yellow fat disease, which is basically, the reason it's called yellow fat is because of this accumulated peroxidation byproducts in their brains and their retinas. So to me, that's yet another argument against the fact that omega-3 are beneficial for vision or brain, is because if you don't consume enough vitamin E, you will develop yellow fat disease. People who used to work on fish trawlers they very commonly develop that. And then the industry realized that and they started feeding them food that was supplemented with vitamin E. But anyways, they basically became deranged. They developed dementias. They became psychotic, aggressive, etc. And in their latest forms of the disease, before they die, they actually became semi-blind. So if anything, an excess of omega-3 is more likely to harm your retina and your brain instead of help it. So for me, considering that we have no evidence that it's actually needed, I would actually stay away from it. Multiple studies have come out said that despite the fact that about 30% of babies that are exclusively breastfed are actually developing EFA deficiency, and despite that fact, these babies grow to be much healthier, much more resilient, and much smarter than their formula-fed or omega-3 supplemented brethren or sisters, to me speaks enough that we don't need to mess by adding more omega-3 than is already present in breast milk.
I also think it's kind of ironic that omega-3s are like exponentially more unstable than omega-6s, which are exponentially more unstable than omega-9s, and then obviously saturated fats. But it's like omega-3s are theoretically worse than omega-6s, right? Because they're so much more likely to undergo lipoxidation.
I mean, there's all of these positions where basically one of the reactive oxygen species can attack. Mm-hmm. So if you have two times more, in fact, they're so susceptible to lipid peroxidation that most of the fish oil products that you're getting on the market, unless they have some vitamin E added to them, they already smell rancid.
Yep.
And it was turned out to be one of the biggest problems in clinical trials. And this is why, I don't know if you've seen the commercials for the pharma drug based on omega-3 called Lovaza, I think it's called, L-O-V-A-Z-A. It's basically esters of omega-3s because they're slightly more resistant to peroxidation. The company running the clinical trials with Lovaza actually initially started with regular unesterified omega-3s and found out that a large portion of the trial recruitments dropped out. They were developing nausea, diarrhea. They said we get fish breath all the time. Our bodies start reeking of fish. We don't like this, right? So they created these esters. They're actually the ethyl esters of DHA and EPA. And it got approved by the FDA as a drug for lowering triglycerides. But even then, basically, even those fatty acid esters, if you look at their instructions, they're instructing you to consume your basically your prescription, monthly prescription within that month. And if you skip a month, in other words, if you have something left over that's like 2 months or older, they say you should discard it. So it's already known that these lipids are highly peroxidizable. And again, the only argument we have for their benefit, considering that all of the randomized placebo-controlled trials with adults and young adults, and even children so far have failed with both omega-3 and omega-6, the only thing we have left is an argument, quote-unquote, for feeding into babies is that they've been shown to accumulate, you know, in higher amounts in babies in the retina and the brain, right? But then the presence of yellow fat disease and the fact that breastfed babies, even if EFA deficiency, are much healthier and much smarter and better vision, and even actually they live longer. To me, is an argument that there is no argument that we should be supplementing omega-3. We're still waiting on an argument, sufficiently strong argument that giving them is bad, right? But the argument so far that they're good is not there. Yeah. There's no evidence for that.
What do you think of the tocotrienols?
I think the fact that they're unsaturated may present some problems. I've seen studies with mice, rats, cats, and rabbits. And in I think two of those studies that I saw, they noticed liver enlargement, which is usually a sign of estrogenicity. Now, whether that was due to the tocotrienols or the formulation that they were given in, that's, they didn't say. They said they were dissolved in oil. Yeah, but what oil, right? So maybe if you give them dissolved in PUFA, the effect is much more pronounced negatively than if you just give the tocotrienols themselves. I tried Unique E, the company, used to have a tocotrienol product long time ago. I don't know if they still have it.
I don't think so.
I tried it. I kind of liked it, to be honest with you. I didn't have bad reactions to it. It kind of improved my mood. But, I didn't feel that much of a difference between their Unique E product at the time that was the mixed tocopherols, right, and the tocotrienols. And then over time, their Unique E product, the tocopherols, they seem to start getting like very lighter in color. And more liquidy, so I thought they were maybe adding some oil. Anyways, that was my experimentation back in circa 2014, 2015. So my personal experience with the tocotrienols was not bad, but the studies suggest there may be some estrogenicity, especially if combined with PUFA.
I have a two-parter. So whenever it comes to vitamin E, at what point can you overdo it? And then whenever it comes to antioxidants in general, can you get into an overly reductive state?
I don't think you can do that with vitamin E. With vitamin E, the problem is that it's actually more of a structural antioxidant, where basically the problem with the other antioxidants, such as NAC, right, which is also heavily promoted, or glutathione, the reduced portion, GSH, those actually can put you in a reductive state. While the tocopherols, the presence of tocopherols, because it's such a, is sort of like a lipidy molecule, and if it accumulates actually in the same area where the lipids are in the cell, so it's protected them physically from the attack of the actual reactive oxygen species. While the other, the true reductants, are actually donating electrons, and they can actually put you in a truly reductive state because usually the acceptance of that electron is NAD. So you're going to get a relative deficiency of NAD, which will drop the NAD to the NADH ratio. The problem with heavy supplementation with tocopherol, aside from the fact that it tends to irritate the GI tract, especially if you don't take it mixed with some kind of a fat, if it's just the pure tocopherols, they're extremely viscous and they tend to stick to the mucosal areas. So if you rub some on your gums, undiluted, and or on your lips, you'll see that they'll stay there for an entire day, no matter how much you lick it or like you eat food and whatnot, or you drink water. So unless you're eating some fatty meal, they can actually dissolve it and get it away from that surface, you'll stay stuck there. And over time, even you can feel it even in your gums, because I've tried this effect, because Dr. Peters mentioned several people not reacting well to vitamin, that it may be irritating their gut. I've tried this in my mouth, and if you actually leave it there for a few hours, you start getting itchy, which is usually an indication of a histamine release and or serotonin, and it's not a good sign. So very large doses can cause intestinal irritation. But even before you reach that point, anything beyond, I would say, 2 grams daily, which is a massive dosage, anything beyond 2 grams daily, you basically, because of the inhibition of the cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase enzymes, you basically have a platelet, anti-platelet aggregating effect. So you'll be very prone to bleeding. So in fact, in my experience, vitamin E has higher risk of causing bleeding issues than aspirin does, even aspirin in very high doses. In fact, the risk with aspirin is somewhat paradoxical. They seem to be much higher with lower dosages, up to a tablet a day, especially the baby aspirin. And once you cross the threshold of, let's say, like 2-3 tablets a day and higher, then the majority of the effects of aspirin are metabolic. They're not really hemostatic. Well, tocopherol, actually, if you take it in sufficiently high doses, usually above 2 grams, you basically get into a point where you may be prone to bleeding. And this means it's increasing your requirements for vitamin K. And some studies have demonstrated that because vitamin E and K apparently depend on the same protein produced by the liver for transport to peripheral tissues, if you're taking too much vitamin E continuously, you may be preventing not so much the absorption of vitamin K from the diet, but its actual transport to peripheral tissue. So you may accumulate it in the liver, and who knows what the liver will do with excess vitamin K. Maybe it will excrete it, you know, or maybe at some point it will accumulate to the point where it becomes toxic. It's not known. But what it is known is that if you give sufficiently high dosages to animals, which are equivalent to human doses in the excess of 2.5 grams daily, after a month, you will develop vitamin K deficiency in peripheral tissues. So that's really like the main issue that I see with it.
Is that why Ray doesn't like supplementing K and E at the same time?
Well, they also react, okay. Right? Basically, I mean, the basically K and E react, and the E converts it to the hydroquinone that I mentioned. And the hydroquinone is actually highly susceptible to interaction, interaction under UV light. So you can create phototoxicity. So that's the thing. That's where the pro-oxidant, in a bad sense, effect from vitamin E is coming from. If you take K and E so that the E is converted into the hydro semi-quinone, under the effects of ultraviolet light and potentially molecular oxygen, you're getting basically a phototoxicity reaction. But it's still dependent on PUFA. Without PUFA, there'll be very little for the basically the ultraviolet light to damage there or activate a molecule to cause damage.
And Ray has also talked about vitamin C acting as a structural antioxidant, correct? Where it's not in like the ascorbic acid form, it's in the ascorbate form, which is more like fat soluble. So it's just sitting there kind of like the vitamin E.
The ascorbic acid is in the reduced form, right? So when you take it, it's actually a reductant. But once in the body, it gets oxidized to dehydroascorbic acid. That's the portion that basically has a structural antioxidant effect and also is vital for the function of the adrenal glands. The regular ascorbic acid is not. So it needs to get converted into dehydroascorbic acid. But in order for that to happen, you have good oxidative, you need good oxidative metabolism. And if you don't, you may be basically impeding steroidogenesis, not just in the adrenal, but also in the gonads, because vitamin C seems to accumulate most in the adrenals and the gonads, the testicles in males and the ovaries in females. And it's only capable of assisting there when it's in its oxidized form called dehydroascorbic acid.
Okay, interesting.
But in order for it to get converted, one electron needs to get removed, and for that you need NAD because that's really the acceptor. Other methods are, and in fact there is a chemical, there's actually a pharma drug on the market that's using this remarkable pro-health structural antioxidant effect of dehydroascorbic acid. So they're administering the reduced version, ascorbic acid, which is very cheap, right? They're administering together with a quinone, which will oxidize it once in the body. That quinone is vitamin K3, which is almost the same as vitamin K2, just a shorter aliphatic chain, so it's less lipophilic, but it's still the same quinone effects. And basically what happens is, you know, and that drug is called Apatone, and it was shown to stop terminal prostate cancer that was basically, people were told there's nothing that we can do for you that's metastatic, right? Go home and die, basically. And so Apatone was able to stop that. And now Apatone is in clinical trials, which is nothing but a combination of 5 grams vitamin C and 50 milligrams of vitamin K3. That is all there is. And it's administered by an injection. That drug is now in clinical trials for ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, and I believe lung cancer. And the trials are still ongoing. I think it has a lot of promise. But if nothing else, should be a great indication that the metabolic therapy works for cancer. Now we have at least one drug that's already approved for such use.
I was curious as to what your personal protocol is whenever you go out and are exposed to PUFA.
Oh, vitamin E, without a doubt. And also Orange juice seems to help a lot because it has the flavonoids inside, specifically flavones and flavanones. The flavones, the one that is present in orange juice, I think is apigenin, and the flavanone that is in orange juice and also grapefruit juice is naringenin. Both of these are good, and actually they're capable of acting as redox molecules. In other words, they're capable of accepting electrons and then donating them. But when you're ingesting them from orange juice, they're in their oxidized form, which means they're similar to actually ingesting vitamin K. And they have the redox potential is the same. They can accept two electrons and then they can donate two electrons. So I would take vitamin E either a little bit before the meal or like with it or a little bit after. The good thing about vitamin E is that you don't have to take it every day. Its half-life is 48 to 60 hours, which means that if you take it two or three times a week only, that's probably enough. And several studies have actually shown that you can get away with taking it only once a week because it accumulates in the liver and the liver seems to be releasing it into the bloodstream in correlation with the amount of PUFA, whether from the diet or being released from the tissues by lipolysis. So to me, that's probably the cheapest and most widely available method. If that is not available, if you can get access to good orange juice, even if it's from concentrate, I would drink a glass of that daily, and that should probably be okay because the flavones and flavanones accumulate in tissues, similar to the tocopherols. They're lipophilic molecules, and they can stay in your tissues for a very long time. Some studies have shown that the half-life of the already accumulated flavones and flavanones in the fatty tissues, because that's where they prefer to accumulate, which is nice because they protect the PUFA there, right? It's the same as the PUFA, which is the half-life is 2 years.
So I have a question that I've thought about. Why is there any reason or like, could you just use coconut oil topically or any sort of saturated fat to help saturate your fat stores? I know that obviously the absorption is not going to be significant, but you could, if you can absorb fat soluble vitamins through skin, which we do know, I don't see why you couldn't absorb, saturated fatty acids as well and help to saturate your fat stores over time.
That's perfectly feasible. In fact, it's a very common practice in Southeast Asian countries. The Indians do it with ghee and with coconut oil, which tends to be more expensive, but ghee. And then the Southeast Asian cultures, especially Vietnam, Thailand, Burma, the Philippines, they use coconut oil. And basically, women use it for hair treatment as well, for scalp treatment if you have like seborrheic dermatitis or any kind of like a, age spot pigmentation. It they know it's very good, which shows you that it dissolves lipofuscin, at least when it's on the surface, right, or close to the surface. So I think it's a very good method. It will require a significant amount to rub it along your entire body, but maybe you can just concentrate on the midsection because that's really where the dangerous fat is. It's the central obesity that is correlated with virtually all of the chronic diseases, not basically big amounts of subcutaneous fat. If anything, the subcutaneous fat is what makes people look younger because it keeps the skin non-wrinkly. So if you can rub it on your abdomen and your chest and maybe your shoulders, really areas where you think like you're carrying extra fat, since most of the fat is PUFA because PUFA preferentially is stored in the fatty tissues, right? Then you can probably change the composition over time. There are already studies showing that this can be done. Now, for how long before you reach an EFA deficiency, that hasn't been tested. But assuming you absorb around, let's say, 10 to 15% of the applied amount, right? In order to cover an area of your, of your abdomen, basically you'll probably need 2 ounces, I would say, if you really want to rub this area well. About 60 grams, 10% is 6 grams. That's a significant amount of saturated fat basically being absorbed in your peripheral tissues. So if you do it on a daily basis or like almost every day, you're looking at basically the saturated fat outcompeting or outnumbering the PUFA in your bodies after a few months.
Couldn't you also get fat in that regard though from doing that or nah?
No, they're very easily oxidized through the beta oxidation process. Okay. And because they don't need transport into the mitochondria, at least the medium and the short chain fatty acids. They basically, it's like you're rubbing glucose in your body. They'll get converted to energy very quickly.
So if you guys see me in the future just lubed up, it's because Georgie said so. I'm going to be a grease ball.
All I said is try it out.
So is that why calories that you put on your skin don't necessarily correlate to your overall caloric intake?
Yeah, most of what you put on your skin is going to get metabolized before it even reaches the bloodstream, especially if it's like something like fat. And in fact, with the steroids, they found out that you can, because there's this topic, obviously, we're interested in topical absorption of various chemicals, including steroids, such as pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA. Some recent studies have suggested that when you apply the steroids to the skin, it's not that they don't absorb. It's not the absorption that's the problem, but the fact that the skin, because it's the largest steroidogenic and steroid processing organ in your body, and it's actually the largest organ in your body, it metabolizes most of what you apply into other, basically, like steroids that are, or like other molecules. So if you apply pregnenolone, studies have shown that basically you do not detect any changes in blood levels of pregnenolone. But and they thought that's because it doesn't absorb very well. That's not true. It actually absorbs remarkably well because it's a lipid. It's just that the skin likes it so much. And notice the recent study showed that the skin, the cells all over the body accumulate pregnenolone inside of themselves at a ratio of more than 100-to-1 to what's in the bloodstream. So assuming that the cells of most people are relatively deficient in pregnenolone or any other, like, of the good steroids, you know, you have to apply a significant amount before they've had enough and they allow some of it to go to the bloodstream. Probably similar thing with the saturated fats, because the cells like them so much, if nothing else but for energy production. I mean, a significant amount of what you apply basically will get, most of it will probably get absorbed, but not a small portion will end up in a bloodstream, simply because passing through all of these cells before they reach the capillaries, basically the cells will like eat that fat up and turn it into energy.
It's crazy. So you think, I know coconut oil is an SPF of like 2 technically, but you think all the saturated fats would kind of be a good sunscreen in that, at least to protect them?
Everything that can protect. Vitamin E is great as a skin protector, especially if mixed. But you don't need to put much, since there's also the potentially skin irritating effect. So maybe like a 10-to-1 ratio of coconut oil with vitamin E, or like even olive oil and vitamin E, it would be great. And in fact, it's a very common recipe in Mediterranean countries. Either just apply only pure coconut oil, which has some antioxidants such as hydroxytyrosol, which is a derivative of the amino acid tyrosine, and acts in a manner similar to vitamin E. But olive oil also has its vitamin E content too. And it's not that much lower than things like wheat germ oil or corn oil, soybean oil, which are, they've been used commercially for extracting most of the vitamin E on the market, but only because they're so much more cheaper to produce, or at least they're much more mass produced than the olive oil. The olive oil has comparable amounts of vitamin E, but because, if you produce olive oil, it itself fetches a good price. You can't really afford to extract vitamin E from it, because that means essentially wasting on vitamin. So that vitamin E will be astronomically expensive if you end up extracting from there. Anyways, long story short, olive oil is, sort of like a very common and widespread remedy in the Mediterranean, both the European and the Northern African part, for basically skin treatment, for slimming down, for preventing sunburn, or at least like getting this nice tan without the redness and itchiness and peeling skin. So any kind of other fat that does not smell very bad. By the way, lanolin, which is made from sheep wool, right? It's the grease that the sheep's skin cells excrete to protect the wool. That's actually really, really good. It probably beats anything else, including vitamin E, as an antioxidant skin protector. Unfortunately, it has a really, really strong sheep smell. But you can buy deodorated lanolin. If you Google it, you'll find it. Not many companies sell it, but the ones they do, if you get like a bucket, it's really nice. It's basically like you're spreading wax on your skin. It has no smell. It's really nice and silky and smooth, but it absorbs very quickly, right? So your skin doesn't feel greasy after that. And some people are actually using lanolin as a transdermal enhancer, but it's, in my experience, the only form that will be tolerated is the one that's deodorized. Everything else smells horrendous.
That's pretty crazy. So our good friend Jake Miner, coworker, asked why higher testosterone helps balance blood sugar. And I want to know if this happens he also asked if this happens in a dose dependent manner. I thought it was probably because of the nutrient partitioning effect, sending more glucose and amino acids to the muscle cells. But what do you think?
That is certainly a part of it, but I think the biggest part, because the effect is very rapid. If you basically inject a sufficiently high amount of testosterone of a fast acting form of it, such as the base, right, or like a short chain ester such as the acetate, you can cause hypoglycemia. And if that rapid effect tells you that there is an endocrine effect there, and that endocrine effect has to do with cortisol. Testosterone, as most other androgens, basically its anabolic effects are actually mostly anti-catabolic. There are old studies that I posted on the Rapeed forum that show that all of the so-called anabolic steroids discovered so far, basically they owe the vast majority of their effects to the fact that they're cortisol blockers, because the muscle growth is mostly restrained by the presence of cortisol. You remove cortisol altogether, such as by removing the adrenals, and then rats turn into a ridiculously muscular animals that don't look anything like rodents. So the taking anabolic steroids effectively mimics that state of, you know, suppressing the adrenals, or at least blocking the effects of excess cortisol. So anything that lowers cortisol or blocks its effects will drop blood sugar. And in fact, the cortisol blocker, which is popularly known as the abortion pill, mifepristone, also known as RU486, is now actually being trialed for diabetes type 2, both for the obesity portion of it and the insulin resistance, which kind of go hand in hand. And also it's been used for years for the treatment of the hyperglycemia seen in people with Cushing disease, which is the people with excessive production of cortisol. So mifepristone was a drug designed as a cortisol blocker, but it was designed in the 80s. And at the time, basically, the marketing people in the pharma company said, we're not going to make much money if we sell it as a cortisol blocker, but we also found that it blocks the progesterone receptor, which means it causes abortion. So it's a huge market for it. Let's sell it as the abortion pill. But don't forget, it was actually designed as a cortisol blocker. Anyways, story is, anything that blocks cortisol or helps with cortisol disposal, such as, let's say, things that either inhibit 11-beta-HSD1, which synthesizes cortisol, or increase 11-beta-HSD2, which deactivates cortisol, we are going to have hypoglycemic effects. Imodin, which is another quinone, found in cascara mostly, but many other herbs as well, is a powerful inhibitor of HSB1 and is being trialed. I mean, multiple animal studies demonstrated that it rapidly normalizes blood glucose, even in diabetic animals, and now it's being trialed in humans. So if you're seeing basically a blood sugar normalizing effect of something, and if it's rapid, right, if it doesn't take several days for this to happen, my first guess is that it's somehow acting in a manner opposite to cortisol or serotonin, which is another chemical which promotes cortisol by itself, but it can also have hyperglycemic effect.
So on top of these endocrine effects, do you think that one of the differences between DHT and testosterone and the androgenic effects of DHT compared to testosterone is because it's nutrient partitioning to other cells, like more like hair and facial cells, I guess.
Yep, and also it's a much more powerful stimulant of both DNA and RNA synthesis, and also muscle protein synthesis. The reason DHT hasn't seen that much usage as testosterone, first of all, it has bad reputation, right? It's basically like causing hair loss and causing prostate cancer. The first one may be still debatable. The second one is already not. We already have multiple trials showing that with humans, showing that injection of testosterone into the prostate actually stops terminal prostate cancer. And the prostate expresses, of all the enzymes, it expresses the most 5-alpha reductase. So when injected with testosterone, it's going to convert 90%+ of it into dihydrotestosterone, DHT, right? So any argument that androgens are bad for the prostate flies out of the window. And if that was not enough, there's a DHT cream on the market called Andractin. In Europe, it is an officially approved drug for treating prostate enlargement. So how can, you know, a part of the world use DHT to treat prostate issues? The other part of the world says, nope, this is the villain. We're going to give you finasteride or some other drugs that are blocking it. Yeah, unreal. But anyways, so it looks like the anabolic effect is about 80% opposition to cortisol, right? The hypertrophic effect. And the other 20% is stimulation of basically DNA and RNA synthesis, and potentially increasing the expression of various steroidogenic enzymes. So you end up producing even more steroids. I think DHT, as a much stronger androgen than testosterone, excels at the latter, right? But as like testosterone, it has a similar affinity to testosterone for the cortisol receptor. So most people have been taking like 100, the bodybuilders usually inject on average about 100 milligrams testosterone daily, right? I don't know if anybody who's ever tried injecting 100 milligrams dihydrotestosterone daily. So the comparisons that I've seen so far between the steroids are unfair because nobody is using them in a sort of like a comparable dosage when it comes to the glucocorticoid receptor. My guess is that if somebody was using as high of a dosage of DHT as they were using T, they would see an even bigger effect because their effects against cortisol are similar, if not the same. But DHT is a stronger estrogen antagonist and also stronger stimulant of overall protein synthesis and the renovation of the cellular machinery. So the cell will be able to basically like divide more in a controlled manner and create more tissue. That would be my take on it.
So I said kind of one big question from the conversation with Tucker. And he said you have to consume less fat than you eat in order to lose fat, because all fats are stored. Then he also said, he seemed to allude to most carbs are also stored, which I thought it was interesting that he said most fats are stored. And I've been thinking about that. I don't know if I agree with that. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. But I also thought I completely disagreed with the carbs are all stored. And then he also said PUFA are preferentially stored or oxidized. Then he said he sent you some papers that said they were oxidized. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts generally on that.
He hasn't sent me that. I mean, I don't want this to necessarily accuse him of anything. Yeah. Maybe he just forgot. But the studies that I have seen show that they actually fed people and animals deuterated sugars so they can actually see how much of the dosage that was fed ended up in lipids. And basically, you have to feed a human in excess of 1 pound of sugar daily before you actually see some, you know, notable synthesis of palmitic acid, right, which is what gets synthesized through the fatty acid synthase pathway. And even that actually, because it's palmitic, because it's saturated, it will probably get oxidized before it even makes it to the tissues. Now, when you're eating the fats, the studies that I have seen and that I've shown, actually I've posted them on the forum and my blog, show that the saturated fats are preferentially oxidized. The liver loves them. And maybe that's one reason why there are some studies showing that you can take alcoholics, cirrhotic alcoholics, that the liver is almost, you know, about to fail completely. And you start feeding them saturated fats such as butter or coconut oil. And not only they can, basically their fibrosis of the liver fully disappears in the presence of continued alcohol abuse. So you turn them into happy, healthy alcoholics by feeding them saturated fat. And the effect is mostly due to the saturated fat blocking the effects of PUFA on the liver and potentially endotoxin as well. So it shows you the liver disease is actually a PUFA peroxidation or a direct PUFA problem. Giving saturated fat, it cures it. So the only way for the saturated fat to have this effect is to actually stay there in the liver, right? So the liver actually has a tremendous capacity for utilizing and even storing saturated fats. It doesn't seem to like the polyunsaturated fats, and that may be one reason why when you actually measure a urine output and start looking for the fatty acids there, right, the ones that are glucuronidated are primarily PUFA, and the ones that are free fatty acids are actually primarily saturated fatty acids. To me, that's an argument that the liver does not like the polyunsaturated fats and does its best to actually excrete them, while the PUFAs are basically either esterified or released in a free form beyond what the liver can consume. And the liver can consume, can actually utilize a very large amount of fats on a daily basis.
So do you think that you do need to saturated PUFA, no matter, you still need to consume less fat than you're burning in order to lose fat?
So basically at rest, your muscles are burning mostly fat. So the amount of basically lean muscle tissue or lean muscle mass, or the amount of fat tissue, conversely, right? So you would want to be at a fat percentage below 15% body fat. If that's the case, then you can probably get away without actually modifying diet much beyond avoiding the PUFA and exercising at all. Now, if you have a higher amount of fat, I think it will be beneficial to cut down on the intake of fat, but I will still consume the carbs because I'm convinced beyond any reason about that, at least for myself, that if you lower the fat and lower the carbs as well, right? So you eat this high protein, what did he call it? Muscle tissue sparing, high protein diet?
Yeah, I think
what the term was.
Yeah, something like that. It was like some fancy name with like, I'll think on it, but.
But it was high protein diet at the expense of the other two macronutrients. So he's saying you have to lower the amount of fat in the diet, which I agree with. He's saying you also have to lower the amount of sugar because it's going to keep lipolysis down and you don't want that, right? And then you basically eat a lot of calories as protein. To me, that diet is not optimal. Multiple studies have shown that you can actually fry your kidneys if you eat a sufficiently high protein diet. And basically, if you're eating carbs, it's going to keep lipolysis down, but this is actually you want it. It will not block it fully. There is always some baseline lipolysis. And basically, if the liver is functioning, that baseline lipolysis will be, the liver will be able to handle it. So these free fatty acids will pass through the liver, and the liver, because it does not like the PUFA, it will tend to glucuronidate it, make it more water soluble, and you should be able to pee it up. And some of that gets excreted with the stool as well. Because there's this continuous circulation between the liver, the gallbladder, and the gastrointestinal tract, right? So I would not want to increase lipolysis more by basically eating a low-carb diet, and even more so by exercising. Because I think that was his argument, right? You go on the low-carb, low-fat, high-protein diet, you're already talking basically elevated lipolysis because you're not consuming sufficient carbs. And on top of that, you want to burn more fat by providing more fat by elevating lipolysis. Now, the body has a capacity for oxidizing fat. And several studies have shown that when you go on long distance runs, even if they're not very intensive, basically beyond the 10-mile mark, you're getting into a situation of liver failure. There's a study that I posted on the forum maybe 4 years ago showing that a majority of marathon runners get to the finish line in a state of basically acute kidney failure. And most of them recover, right? But would you want, does that sound like something positive that you want to do on a daily basis? Now, I'm not saying you will always give yourself kidney failure, right, if you're lowering the carbs. But if you're lowering the carbs and you're also increasing the exercise, I think you're increasing lipolysis to a point where the organs will get overwhelmed with that fat. And of course, since that fat is mostly PUFA, the lipid peroxidation will start. And in fact, they even have like these protocols for animal studies where they actually measure the T-bars. They use the T-bars assay to actually measure at what point they're stressing the animals with exercise too much. And they've calculated, the thing for rats was that it's basically an hour of running on their wheels like a day, right? Not anything more than that, the T-bars rises and basically like all of these toxic byproducts start to appear as well. That would be a good indication that you'll probably start to damage organs, peripheral organs. And the most susceptible ones to the elevated lipolysis, which is mostly PUFA, are the kidneys, the liver, and the brain.
And that's like one of the main benefits of having more muscle mass, right? It's just that you burn more fat at rest. So that's going to take away some of the fat in the bloodstream, which is going to decrease the Randall cycle so that the organs and everything else can increase more carb.
So try to do whatever's possible to increase lean muscle mass, right? And you keep your organs as healthy as possible. Elevated lipolysis will not do the latter, right? So basically concentric exercises such as actually lifting weights is a mix, is a concentric and eccentric, but things like climbing stairs or like rowing,
sprinting,
or like
jumps,
even biking,
right?
Or swimming, yes, exactly, jumps, things like that, those are almost purely concentric exercises. And it's been shown that your muscles can actually act almost identical to your gonads and produce much more testosterone than your gonads produce when you stimulate the muscles with concentric exercise. So it's going to produce testosterone locally, which is going to have to lead to that basically anti-cortisol hypertrophic effect on muscles. You're going to have more muscles. You're going to burn more fat at rest, right? Or at least with mild exercise. You don't want to get to a point where you can actually tell it by the smell. You start smelling like glycerol. And I think actually they sell, you can get like the ketone strips, right? But they're only good for full-blown ketosis for people that are, I guess, diabetic or practicing the low-carb diet for a long time. But they also have these devices, these breathalyzer devices, when they can tell you when you're basically like exhaling too much glycerol. And that is a byproduct of fatty acid oxidation, right? Because the fatty acids exist in the form, storage form, are triglycerides. So when they start getting broken down for oxidation or any other purpose, the glycerol will basically like start floating around. It also gets metabolized. But accumulation of glycerol, rising of glycerol in the blood is an indication of excessive lipolysis. And you can feel it on your breath if you get trained enough. So, you know, if you get to that point, if you learn how to like sense yourself when you're starting to become glycerolic or smell like glycerol, you've overdone it. You don't want to get to that.
So what are your thoughts on acute lactate, like from exercise, increasing just like the thought processes? And I think they've shown it in rats that the lactate goes to the Leydig cells and testes, which increases testosterone synthesis there, which then in turn has a nutrient partitioning effect. And potentially, I guess you said as well, the exercising causing the testosterone increase in the cells as well. But so do you think that acute lactate can have a beneficial effect in the short term?
Well, if you're like, I mean, it's preferential to fatty acids because the fatty acids are basically slow fuel. And multiple studies have shown that basically people on a low carb diet and in general diet that induces ketosis, they have a drastically lower levels of testosterone. So we know that fatty acid burning, predominantly fatty acid burning, is not good for the testosterone production. Now, lactate, my personal take on it is that, it, by the way, it can very easily get converted back to pyruvate if you have sufficient amounts of NAD. So I haven't seen the studies that have shown directly that it's the lactate that's stimulating the synthesis of testosterone. If these cells are in a well-nourished environment with sufficient amounts of oxidized cofactors such as NAD, and they usually put NAD only because they know NAD can easily get reduced. They don't do NADH. So these medians contain a sufficient amount of NAD to actually convert the lactate back to pyruvate, right? And then that pyruvate may be going through the Krebs cycle of these cell cultures that they're testing, and you know, serving as fuel to actually similar to glucose to stimulate testosterone synthesis. Another possible role could be is that it's been shown that the last step of the synthesis of testosterone, which is the 17 beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, it depends on the reducing cofactor, which is NADH or NADPH. Lactate being a reductant may be able to help in that last step and generate these required cofactors specifically for that enzyme. In the place where it's located, and that could speed up the last step of synthesis. Now, I would be curious to see what are the effects of lactate on the other steps of the steroidogenesis. Suppose it increased synthesis of testosterone, but inhibited the, let's say, the conversion of cholesterol to pregnenolone. That would not be a good result, right? Or inhibited any of the other downstream steps, the 3-beta-HSD1, the 17-21 lyase, on the path to testosterone. And one thing that is certain is that lactate actually activates aromatase. So even though it may have stimulated testosterone synthesis, if a good portion of it ends up as estrogen, I don't know what the net effect will be. Would it be positive, negative? It's hard to say.
And so Tucker also said that 90% of fructose is converted to glucose in the digestive tract.
I don't know if it's in the digestive tract or in the cells, because there's like one step in the glycolysis where basically fructose circumvents it, but after that it gets converted into like an intermediary of glucose metabolism and then gets oxidized the same for the rest of glycolysis. I don't think the 90% number is accurate. There may be a study showing that, but because we're seeing that basically when people consume, let's say, high fructose corn syrup or sucrose, the levels of both fructose and glucose rise in the body, in the blood proportionally, which tells me that if it was a 90% conversion into the gastrointestinal tract, then it should be seeing mostly glucose into the bloodstream. But that's not the case. We're seeing actually a significant amount of fructose into the bloodstream. Another thing is that most of the studies that used the fructose feeding in order to demonstrate a fattening effect on the liver, when they measured the fructose levels into the liver, they found drastic increase again. But if there was a 90% conversion again, they should have seen actually mostly glucose end up in the liver and not fructose. So there may be one study showing that, but in my experience, the ones that I've seen, it's not the case.
Do you think you can overconsume fructose and like, cause it's only metabolized in the liver pretty much, right? Maybe like 1-2% in the cells, but is it pretty much always going to be stored as glycogen, or is the liver just going to be able to so for fructose, can you overconsume fructose, or is the liver pretty much always going to be able to burn it or store it as glycogen, which I know it does preferentially? Is there going to be capacity for that? Or you think it's just so readily oxidized?
If you consume pure fructose, there may be a portion where it basically starts get. I mean, it will get. I don't think the liver consumes all of it. I don't think the 1-2% peripheral number is accurate. I think it's more like 70-30. We're seeing a significant amount of fructose into the blood after a person consumes sucrose, right? And the reproductive organs, they basically heavily depend on fructose. Amniotic fluid is very high on fructose. The base sperm is very high on fructose. The ovarian environment, the testicular environment, all of these cells there and the fluids that are there are very high in fructose. So a large amount of fructose is needed by peripheral tissues. I don't know the exact percentage, but it's not 1 or 2. The brain is actually capable of metabolizing fructose. In fact, it's been shown that fructose injection directly into the brain increases the mitochondrial density of neurons. So maybe the brain doesn't get as much as it wants to, right? But if you give it to the brain will certainly be able to metabolize it. Can you overconsume fructose? Well, again, it will depend on the, we have to do some blood work, but the ones that I've seen from people where the fructose was consumed together with glucose, but in amounts really excessive, such as a kilo of basically sucrose daily, did not increase the triglycerides beyond baseline. So which means that you can consume at least a pound of fructose a day and not have a detrimental effect as far as the blood lipid parameters are concerned. You may see some increase in cholesterol, but it's only the oxidized cholesterol that is dangerous, and that oxidized cholesterol can only form if there is PUFA. No PUFA, no oxidation of cholesterol, and cholesterol, as we all know, is vital for the functioning of the body, and the fact that fructose increases LDL is not sufficient to say that fructose is detrimental.
Awesome, thank you. I just got one last question, unless Jayden has something. Olive oil, like, what do you think assuming we can get the non-rancid, like good quality form with adequate vitamin E from like a good source, whatnot, and avocado oil, I would throw in this as well. Do you think like we can consume it regularly? Or you really don't want like maybe kind of a intermittently, obviously not for high cooking as well, but, or do you really want to prioritize the saturated fats as much as possible?
So here's the thing. If you had a choice between, you know, if you have to eat commercial food most of the time and you had a choice of it being made with olive oil versus like any of the other commercial oils they're using, I would go with olive oil any day, right? Even if I have to consume it in large amounts. It does have about 8 to 10% PUFA, right? But it's still nowhere near what you'll be consuming if you eat the commercial cooked foods, which is mostly canola oil, soybean oil, rapeseed oil, things like that. Even cottonseed oil, which is the worst, because it actually has a sterilizing agent in it called Gossypol, G-O-S-S-Y-P oil. If you look it up, you'll see that it was actually under development as a male sterilizing agent, as a male contraceptive pill. Anyway, so all of these oils that are being used for commercial food, of course, they're going to pick the cheapest ones, and they're not going to be less than optimal, so to speak. So preferable to that, definitely olive oil. And I will take the unrefined kind, because it's the unrefined kind that contains both the vitamin E and also some of the polycosinols, which are the very long-chain fatty acid alcohols, which have also shown very high, very good protective effects as far as cardiovascular disease is concerned. As far as whether it's preferential to eat saturated fat, sure. So for maybe for cooking saturated fat, and then for things like salads, or you know, some meals that are colder, right? We actually need it, like a fat will stay liquid at a cooler temperature. Then you can eat, you can use like a spoon or two of olive oil. That would be my ideal. In fact, that's what I usually, you know, if I get a chance to cook something myself or get a chance to talk to the person cooking it, that's usually what I request. Cook with butter, ghee, or coconut oil. The fully saturated coconut oil, in my opinion, is inconvenient. You have to wait for a very long time before it melts. But things like ghee and beef tallow seem to work pretty well as cooking oils, and butter. And then anything else that will be eaten at a cooler temperature, olive oil seems to work great, especially salads. Like where if you have to saute vegetables, right? It's usually good. It tastes very good to eat them with some. So the sauteing can be done with beef tallow or butter. But if, you know, if somebody wants to add some more oil on top of it, because olive oil does seem to get to give like a extra taste, extra texture of taste to like to things that are relatively bland in taste, such as cooked vegetables. That oil goes very well with vegetables for some reason. When you eat them as like a salad, as a side dish. Well, for cooking them, I think the butter and the ghee and the beef tallow will be preferable because of the animal aftertaste. Like the grease, the animal grease gives it a good taste during cooking. But if you're eating as a side dish, olive oil seems to work better.
Awesome. You have anything else?
Yeah. If you could speak to two people, anybody, one dead, one alive, who would they be and what would you talk to them about?
Dead would probably be Otto Warburg, because I think he had it figured out what the cancer is, 100% metabolic disease. For whatever reason, he didn't make that last push because he was a Nobel laureate. People would have listened, right? And I think he wanted to do some studies with some pro-metabolic substances for cancer. To my knowledge, these all fell apart. Whether it's because of political influence or not, I don't know. That's what I would like to figure out. But you know, for me, at least it would confirm that sort of like whatever progress we had in medicine and science largely aided in the 1940s and 50s. And everything since then is a dogma. Alive? I mean, I don't know. Well, maybe President Putin. Doesn't guarantee that he's going to tell me the truth, but I would ask him, what's your end goal? And is it really America that you consider the enemy or the people in charge of America? And I don't mean the politicians that are in Congress, and I don't want to get too much into conspiratorial stuff, but basically, there's many people have said Joe Biden is not in charge. There's other people pulling the strings. So my question would be, President Putin, are you fighting those people or do you just hate the Americans in general? I suspect the answer will be the former. I mean, I think he said it several times, but, lately it's been a lot of propaganda that, America is at war with Russia. It's basically us or them. The Russians hate us. We hate them. We're incompatible as people. I disagree, right? But, it would be interesting to ask him and see what he has to say, if he would answer.
So I like to ask this question. We're all kind of researchers independently and whatnot. Is there anything that's been like pondering around your head that you've just been thinking about, like some new argument your research found that's just like been bouncing around in there?
I'm running some trials with animals, basically with vitamin B1 and B3 for cancer. And I found out, because it's my study, really, nobody else is involved, basically that the vitamin B1 and B3 can stop the most lethal type of cancer they have. But the tumors did not disappear. Now, because of this metabolic therapy and the effects that it has, the known ones are mostly on the oxidation of carbs through pyruvate dehydrogenase and basically the lowering of lactate, right, and providing more NAD. Now, I'm going to repeat that study, but I'm going to add some more cofactors for pyruvate dehydrogenase, such as alpha lipoic acid and magnesium, and see if that improves the effects. And I'm going to replace the regular B1 with one of the more fat-soluble analogs, such as allethiamine, benfotiamine, sulfotiamine, sulbutiamine, prosulthiamine, and see if that changes it. Because some studies in animals seem to show that the synthesis, the active form of thiamine is thiamine pyrophosphate. But the body, just like with vitamin B6, the cheap version that's on the market is pyridoxine hydrochloride. But the active form is pyridoxal 5-phosphate. The enzyme that converts the precursor to the active form, the activity seems to decline with age and disease. And the precursor itself doesn't really have that much of an effect. In fact, it can be toxic. It can be neurotoxic if you administer too high amounts. And some studies have shown, at least in animals, that if you give them massive doses of the regular thiamine, which is either the hydrochloride salt or the mononitrate salt, it accumulates, but the active form, which is the thiamine pyrophosphate, it does not increase. And that is the form that is the cofactor for pyruvate dehydrogenase. Now, conversely, there are studies showing that if you administer any of the more lipid-soluble precursors, there is a rapid increase in the levels of thiamine pyrophosphate. So that will be my goal going forward, is to get to the point where we can actually show that tumors can not only be stopped but fully disappear. In other words, complete regression of cancer using 100% over-the-counter pro-metabolic substances with whose only known effect is basically effect on the flow of electrons, mostly in the mitochondria.
Do you have a fat-soluble B1, former B1 in Energen? Because I know Jayden and I both tried that. We both loved it.
Right behind me, there's like we have basically a big bag of prosulthiamine, which you can look it up. It's one of the fat-soluble analogs, and we're going to be either replacing the regular thiamine or basically releasing a version of Energen with that one for slightly higher price maybe. For people to try and compare. I personally like it a lot. I think we're just going to replace the regular thiamine just so that everything that we have in the product is basically the activated B vitamins.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Energen. I know. I think you enjoyed it as well. Where can we find you? Or where can the subscribers find you? We know where to find you.
Mostly the blog. Basically, I post online under the alias Haidut, spelled H-A-I-D as in dog, U-T as in Tom. So my blog is haidut.me, M-E. My blog, right? And then that thing feeds into my Twitter account, which is twitter.com/Haidut again. And I also post on the Ray Pete forum, named after Dr. Ray Pete. He's not affiliated with it, by the way, in case people are wondering. It's raypeteforum, one word, .com. And again, my alias there is Haidut. So these three places. And that's pretty much it. And people can get in contact with me through these mediums if they want to exchange ideas.
And Georgie sells some cool supplements from idealabs.com.
Idealabsdc.com, right?
Yes, yes. I tried to get idealabs.com. It was registered. I contacted a person who had it. They asked for an obscene amount of money. So because we're based in DC, I just registered idealabsdc.com, and that's the website for the company.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your time, Georgie. Thank you for giving it to us.
Yeah, it's been an honor. Hopefully we can do this again.